You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Go up to anyone on the street in Los Angeles. Ask what city issue they care about most, and chances are you're going to hear something like this answer from Adele Wallace.
Everywhere you go, you see tents on the street. It really breaks my heart because it doesn't have to be that way.
Wallace is sitting on a bench at Echo Park Lake with a couple of friends.
I can't believe I live in a city where there's a lot of really comfortable people, and then there's people on the sidewalk.
The two candidates running to become LA's next mayor say they agree. Karen Bass and Rick Caruso are both making big promises about reducing the city's huge homeless population, more than 41,000 people by last count. But maybe their promises are too big. What powers does the mayor actually have when it comes to solving homelessness? Here's KCRW's Anna Scott with that story.
The two candidates running for mayor differ in obvious ways. On one side, you have Karen Bass, a Black woman, a former community activist turned Democratic politician who currently represents parts of LA as a U.S. representative. On the other side, there's Rick Caruso, a white billionaire real estate developer and a former Republican. He registered as a Democrat early this year. No surprise, they sound very different when they talk about homelessness.
In Los Angeles, we have an absolute emergency with tens of thousands of people sleeping on our streets every night.
Bass talks about homelessness as a humanitarian emergency and focuses a lot on her strong ties to the Biden administration, promising to bring in federal aid. Caruso talks more about the impacts on public space, the visible parts of the crisis, like in this ABC 7 news segment.
And then you have the amount of drugs that are on the street, the amount of waste that's on the street, the smell in the area.
He speaks more to voters who are simply fed up and want sidewalks and parks cleared of encampments. Yet, as different as they sound, when you look at the concrete things Bass and Caruso are proposing to do about homelessness, there's a lot of overlap. They both say they'll make it easier to build new affordable housing, ask the Biden administration for more low-income rental vouchers, and expand the shelter system. And they're both promising LA voters a major reduction in street camps in year one, to which outgoing Mayor Eric Garcetti says, good luck.
I know it's election time and people should put really bold goals forward, but homelessness isn't going to turn around in a year.
Bass says she'll move 15,000 people into housing or shelter during her first year as mayor. Caruso says he'll add 30,000 new shelter beds, tripling the current number, which Garcetti points out could cost more than $700 million a year from who knows where. So what does Garcetti have to say to voters about what's realistic?
I would tell people that there's no cavalry and that the mayor of Los Angeles is not some all-powerful being.
Obviously, that would make a terrible campaign slogan.
But she or he does have an opportunity to marshal resources. We have some formal power. We can build housing like this.
He says housing like this because we're speaking at a new affordable housing complex built partly with city money.
We can erect shelters. We can move a budget from $10 million to more than $1 billion to address homelessness like we've done. But most of the causes into homelessness and most of the solutions out of homelessness aren't in the jurisdiction of a mayor.
Okay, so of course the outgoing mayor says he did all that a mayor can do. But plenty of people who work on homelessness in LA say the next mayor can do better.
There are absolutely things within the city's control. I think some of it the city is doing but needs to do more of.
Heidi Marston recently quit her job as head of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, an agency that works for the city and county. Marston says one thing the city could do better is simply focusing and doubling down on the things that are within city control, like land use and housing policy.
Zoning and rent control. It's building new affordable housing or maintaining affordable housing. It's acquisition of property to convert into options.
Marston says local solutions to homelessness are not all in city hands, like the county controls social services, for example. But the next mayor could be better at staying in his or her lane and owning it.
As opposed to right now, where you have this mesh of trying to build a little bit, creating a whole lot of shelter. You have the city funding services to fill some of the gaps from the county, as opposed to like city can focus on infrastructure and county can focus on services.
Advocates for the unhoused also say the next mayor could do a better job of using the bully pulpit to articulate a citywide vision and standing up to LA's 15 city council members to get affordable housing and services into every district. Tommy Newman is a vice president with the United Way of Greater Los Angeles.
I think that the mayor has a lot of deference to the city council. I've heard both candidates talk about the need for the mayor to push and do more.
So the mayor can have a big impact on how LA uses land and creates housing. But for voters who want transformative change, a true end to LA's homelessness crisis, that requires tackling the big economic forces that drive an estimated 227 people to become homeless in LA County every day. And solving a big systemic failure requires a big systemic fix, says Dr. Margot Cushell, a physician who directs a homelessness research center at UC San Francisco.
The underlying drivers of homelessness are the lack of deeply affordable housing, income inequality, and structural racism. It's going to be hard to solve this problem without effort from the federal government.
A couple of months ago, standing outside the tent she lives in Koreatown, Maria Demetrio told me what she would like to ask the mayoral candidates.
This is California. It's one of the richest states in this country. Why is this happening, this homelessness?
She says after she lost her job, she couldn't afford rent and got evicted from an apartment just blocks from here. She wants to get back to work, but when outreach workers have come by, they don't have much to offer.
The system failed me. Like, why haven't they helped me? I have a 13-year-old. I'm a grandma. Why haven't I gotten any help? Like, why haven't they pushed the issue?
Back in Echo Park, one of the three women on the bench, Laura Spangler, says even though she has a home, she understands why more and more people like Demetrio have fallen out of LA's housing market in recent decades.
I mean, if I didn't own my house and I wasn't an old lady, there was no way in, can I say hell?
Oh, yes.
That I would be able to live here, you know?
To her, the homelessness crisis is a reminder of the gap between many people's incomes and housing costs in LA. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
Coming up, a new law gets rid of an old one that allowed police to arrest you just because of the way you look. Does the new one decriminalize prostitution? That's yours in a moment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More of Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. On July 1st, Governor Gavin Newsom signed Senate Bill 357, which was designed to decriminalize loitering for the purposes of prostitution. Basically, until this new law, just being on the sidewalk wearing lots of makeup or dressing provocatively was enough of a reason for law enforcement to question and or even arrest you. Activists had long held that was disproportionately affecting women of color and trans women as well. Opponents of the new law say in some cases legal intervention is necessary in the case of sex trafficking, where a victim may not have a choice but to be there. Senator Scott Wiener of San Francisco authored the bill. He's with us right now. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you for having me.
And Ashley Madness is a sex worker organizer with Sex Workers Outreach Project LA, a member of the steering committee for Decriminalized Sex Work California. Ashley, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Senator, you have said that this bill was necessary to stop the targeting of black, brown, and trans women by law enforcement. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, how do you see this as a solution?
Yeah, this law, it was really pernicious. It basically allowed police officers to stop and arrest and prosecute people because the police officer thought that someone looked like they intended to engage in prostitution. So literally, you could just be standing on the sidewalk, and because you're in tight clothes and high heels, and you're standing in a way that to that officer makes it seem like you intend in your head to engage in prostitution, you can literally arrest someone just based on that. And that is so subjective. It's just so subjective that, of course, it's going to lead to profiling. And so what we were seeing was that overwhelmingly the people being arrested for this crime were Black and brown women and particularly trans women. So it's just a law whose time, if it ever existed, it was no longer with us and it needed to go.
The bill, Senator, had several sponsors, including the ACLU, but it also did run up against quite a bit of opposition from anti-sex trafficking and even law enforcement groups, as you could imagine. How do you speak to their claims that this perhaps will make streets less safe?
Yeah, it was a broadly supported bill. ACLU, Equality California, which is the leading LGBTQ civil rights organization in the state, also supported by some of the leading anti-human trafficking advocates in the state. So the most credible organizations that fight human trafficking were supporting this bill. Law enforcement did oppose the bill, as did the California Family Council, which is a homophobic, transphobic organization in California. And, you know, one of the arguments they were making was that a good strategy to fight human trafficking is to arrest people and give them arrest records and potentially convictions. Credible human trafficking advocates will tell you that is not a good strategy. Giving someone an arrest record, it makes it harder for people to get jobs, to get housing. It just makes no sense. And that's really not how this law was being used. It was being used, to profile and target people based on how they look.
But, I mean, one of the points that I know there's this author and former state prosecutor Maggie Krell, right, who said that one of the reasons why this was problematic is because if you are a sex trafficking victim, perhaps the only way that you can get out of it, you know, you're not going to be able to go to law enforcement yourself. It's going to have to be law enforcement intervention.
Well, let's be clear. First of all, the reason that sex workers are scared to go to law enforcement is because they think that if they go to law enforcement, they're going to get arrested. And so laws like this completely undermine confidence in law enforcement. If you're a sex worker and you see an officer down the street and you know that officer can arrest you just based on how you look, you're not going to want to be anywhere near that officer. So these, you know, criminalizing sex work does not make sex workers safer. Criminalizing sex work makes sex workers less safe.
Ashley, can you speak to what this bill will mean in practical terms for sex workers, why it was so important for you?
We wanted to do something that would have an immediate impact or close to immediate impact as far as legislative work is concerned for street-based sex workers. And this, if you are a sex worker who is on the street and working, and if you're anybody else, anybody who's ever been profiled as a sex worker, anybody who's done sex work at one point, so maybe just because you're a sexual being, you have condoms in your purse, this protects, helps, you know, prevent the police from harassing and arresting all of us. So it's very broad-based, but in terms of the day-to-day realities of sex workers, walking around should be safer. Solicitation and prostitution and these other criminal laws are still on the books, but raising that burden of evidence from you're just there to you're there and the police has to argue that you are trying to make a sex work arrangement happen, you're trying to commit an act of prostitution with your communication, that's a meaningfully higher barrier. And we hope that police will be arresting maybe thousands fewer sex workers a year.
What does a safer street look like to you as a sex worker?
A safer street looks like, you know, taco stands open at night instead of police cars rolling down the street. A safer street looks like activated public spaces where there's things that are going on to go to, including public services that are acceptable and accepting. I think often the solution that we see imposed is architecture that makes the city physically more hostile to people just trying to be in public, policing and surveillance that makes it more risky to exist in the city of Los Angeles because there's so many cops and so many surveillance, so much surveillance infrastructure just looking for people to get in trouble, and so many criminal laws that are unjust and baseless, and so much discretion in how people apply, arrest, and prosecute under those criminal laws.
Senator Wiener, the governor was very careful to point out, you pointed it out in this interview as well, that this does not decriminalize prostitution. But isn't that the practical result here? I mean, I know that's ultimately, Ashley, your group's aim, but how about you, Senator Wiener? Is that the ultimate goal? Should that be the ultimate goal?
I personally support decriminalization of sex work, and I hope that we have that conversation at some point soon. It's an important one, but that's not what this bill was about. This bill was very specific to a particular crime that was a loitering crime that was so subjective that it allows the police to target and harass and profile people. So this was a very particular bad law that we were trying to get rid of. There is a broader conversation, but that is not what this, that's not what this was about.
Ashley, this bill doesn't go into effect until next year, right? So we're talking about what it will mean, but in the meantime, are you concerned between now and then?
Yeah, I know police will continue to arrest people under this law, even though the bill also provides a way to get those charges dismissed and to get their records cleared. And so it's heartbreaking, and Swap LA does our normal on the ground peer support and mutual aid to try to help sex workers in Los Angeles out. But, you know, it is a kind of a change in direction at the very least in terms of our approach to sex work in California, and it should make a positive impact as soon as it takes effect.
Well, thank you both for coming on and talking about it. Ashley Madden, a sex worker organizer with Sex Workers Outreach Project LA, and Senator Scott Wiener, author of SB 357. Thank you for coming on, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. Steve Chiotake is here, and let's talk about recycling in Orange County. Quite a few folks hang on to those empty cans and bottles so they can turn them into some extra money. Well, now turning them in is getting harder to do because recycling centers have been going away. A new grand jury report says OC residents are losing millions of dollars every year in unclaimed recycling funds. And on top of that, the state of California is losing hundreds of millions of dollars a year, upwards of $200 million, because of recycling fraud. Gustavo Arellano is columnist for the LA Times, one of our regulars here at GLA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
Now, this is the deposit, or the, what is it, the California Redemption Value Fee, CRV fee, that you pay when you buy that six-pack, right, or a two-liter bottle of Diet Coke. You can get that money back if you take the empty bottle back to the recycling center. But alas, that's the problem here, right?
Yeah, you always forget that this is your money. Like, a deposit is your money that you are entitled to get back. But while we drink that six-pack or the one soda, Mountain Dew or whatever, you just, you know, you get bored. Some people, my parents used to have bought, you know, bags of these things all the time. But then you get older, you're like, it's just too much of a hassle. And that's all wasted money. You just throw it into the recycle bin, and the recycling company gets your deposit as opposed to you getting it.
Now, so the grand jury in OC says residents are losing so much of that money. It just goes to the recycling centers? It doesn't go back to the state? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, so if people do not gather their bottles and cans and go directly to the recycling, any recycling center and get the deposit, it's just in limbo. It's not yours. So what happens is these recycling, these waste disposal companies, they get it. They don't keep that money themselves, but it just stays there in limbo with the state, and the state just keeps amassing it, and, doesn't really do anything much with it. They're just waiting for you, the consumer, the soda drinker, to come claim it, but of course, you're never going to claim it.
Yeah. especially if it's not easy to do. And that's the thing, if they're closing up all over the place. Why is the grand jury looking into this in the first place?
Well, the grand jury can always decide to investigate whatever they want. And some grand juries go for bigger political animals than others. Others really focus on the minutia. But this is interesting with the recycling centers, because I remember growing up, they used to be all over the place. So again, my parents were able to do that. But according to the grand jury report, there's fewer and fewer of them. This is all over the, you know, all over California, but especially in Orange County. So their critique is that, look, especially at a time where Orange County, where you do have poverty now, where you do have stratified society, if you had more of these recycling centers, then that's just another way for people to be able to get a couple of cents. And those couple of cents, we might scoff at that, but they really do build up, especially if that's sometimes only, you know, that's the only added, you know, extra job that you could get, which is just, you know, collect them, go around bins in the mornings and grab them.
Now, there is a statewide plan to expand redemption access, right, and to encourage. Does that mean we're going to be building more recycling centers, or does that mean it's just going to be money for advertising, encouraging you to recycle at places that are fewer and fewer?
It's really interesting, because I never imagined this to be a social justice issue, recycling, but there are people who are saying, look, this is money that belongs to Californians, and especially people, you know, communities, working class communities. This is a way to get them more sense. So under the Newsom administration, the state's going to spend $330 million for all sorts of different things. I do think reminding people, telling people like, hey, this is your money, go get it, that's going to help. But also doing mobile recycling centers, so especially more far off communities, rural communities. You also have something called like a reverse vendor machine where, oh, it's kind of like those old recycling centers that I remember. It's like you go, you put in some cans, except it's not going to be as messy and as noisy. And they'll give you some sort of your deposit back, probably not with money, but probably like a redemption ticket, or maybe you have credit there. So there's definitely different plans to be able to get to this issue.
What about recycling fraud in the state? I mean, a consumer watchdog report says the state's losing upwards of $200 million a year. I mean, how's the recycling program being defrauded?
Oh, gosh, which way can't you defraud it? You know, you go, you put, not that I know, of course, but you put pebbles in cans to make it, your the cans that you get to the recycling center weightier, so they give you more money, or the recycling centers themselves, they double bill, they triple bill. When it comes to making money from government, you know, from a state or whatever, there's always going to be people who figure out a way to defraud it. I mean, look what happened with the coronavirus pandemic and all those funds that Newsom gave out through the state. We have billions of dollars in corruption going off and defrauding. So when it comes to recycling, this is something that's been going on for decades, really, but it's just a drop in the bucket of how people defraud the state of California.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist of the LA Times, regular here at GLA. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
That's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, an update on what's been billed as the last orange grove in the San Fernando Valley. Is it still doomed to become a housing development? That's tomorrow on this program. Later in the week, a new streetcar line is supposed to bring business back to downtown Santa Ana, but its construction is knocked the local businesses off the rails. That story, too, this week on Greater LA, and always online at kcrw.com/GLA. How's it going? Share your thoughts. Give us some story ideas. Subscribe to the podcast at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Rebecca Ludman, Zoe Matthew, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Nick Lampone, Jay Siebold, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl. All made this evening's episode possible. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the ear. Have a great night.